Hello, I'm Beth Kesselman, and this is Smashing the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring and a St. Stephen's Community House production. Thanks for joining us. St. Stephen's Community House acknowledges that our locations are situated upon traditional territories of the Wendat, Anishinaabeg Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations, and the Métis Nation. The treaty that was signed for this particular parcel of land is collectively referred to as the Toronto Purchase and applies to lands east of Brown's Line to Woodbine Avenue and north towards Newmarket. St. Stephen's Community House is a guest, and we recognize the enduring presence of the Indigenous peoples on this land. Welcome back to Smash the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring. Thanks for joining us again. If you'll recall, this week we were going to do two things: talk with an employer about their social hiring practices and also discuss the potential legislative changes with Bill 148. However, we were in the lucky position where we had too much material, so we'll be splitting it up between this, our second episode, and our third episode. So in this episode, we'll feature a conversation I had the pleasure of having with Amanda Turfloth from A Better Way campaign. You'll be joining in just as the conversation started and as some technical difficulties were resolved. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did. Very good. All right. Well, we'll just get to it. And, you know, again, thank you so much for joining us, Amanda. So I don't know if you want to introduce yourself.
My name is Amanda Turfloth, and right now I am the researcher, coordinator, and filmmaker behind Better Way to Build the Economy, which is a group of employers that are already implementing decent wages and better work practices, better scheduling, and it's contributed to their success, not hindered it.
Awesome. Thank you. So if you could please give sort of a synopsis of how you guys came to be and where you where you're going and what your goals are as well.
Well, the Better Way Alliance started initially as a video series. So I started doing research about a year ago, and my main criteria is, or was at the time, how do I find businesses that are already paying $15 an hour or more? That was one of my criteria, that favors secure positions over precarious ones and have already implemented a lot of the changes to the workplace that we know need to happen and have been successful and are willing to talk about it. And so I think what made it a tricky research project in a lot of ways, there's various organizations dedicated to wages, and that is very helpful. So I worked with Living Wage Network in terms of determining the wage aspect of a lot of companies, because if their wage rates aren't public, then finding out kind of what their basic standard is really hard. So that was great in terms of at least starting from a wage basis, but then getting into scheduling. Do they use temp agencies? What other practices have they done? So what I found was a lot of my research was referral based. You know, you can type good companies a billion times, or what I found rather interesting, there's a lot of best places to work lists, which are great, but I've looked at those lists and a lot of the best places to work are paying at least someone in their company under 15. So there's a lot of big companies on there where if you get to the higher levels, you might be making good money, but what does the service staff make? What does the receptionist make? What do they use a lot of temp labor? And you will find some companies on those best places to work lists that use a lot of temporary agency workers. So that wasn't really a helpful place to start, though it kind of gave me some names that maybe I can research these further. So a lot of it was referral. And what I found is companies that are already doing the right thing or have transitioned to doing the right thing know other good businesses. Okay. So a lot of it was word of mouth. And one of our partners specifically, Enviro Stewards, was a referral from Helmy from Grosch International. So I'm doing this as a company, but this is the company that introduced me to the living wage movement, and I think that they would be a good fit for this type of alliance. But it's important to note that when I started, my only, I was looking at this criteria, but my end goal was to make videos. So not only are you trying to find companies that are incorporating all these better practices, but are they willing to talk about it on camera? When there is often a pervasive fear of backlash from businesses that maybe aren't willing to offer these kinds of work environments, basically. And what's fascinating is I know there can be a bit of that, and there definitely is in the Fight for 15 movement. There's constant, backlash. With the Better Way Alliance, I think it's quite telling in terms of there's some backlash, but business owners that are hesitant are sometimes not necessarily willing to get in the fray with other business owners. Whereas if a worker made the same points, maybe they wouldn't necessarily be listened to because it would come from, well, what do you know about running a business? It's hard. There's these costs. This is what I'm dealing with. And that's why I think it was really important to include this perspective, because it's, you can say, what do you know about running a business? Well, I run one. And here's how I'm running it, and here's why it's helping my business. So it was really looking at what business benefits do businesses get when they treat their staff better? And the answer is many benefits. Turnover goes down. Customers are happy. There's so many common sense points in treating your staff right that haven't been amplified at the rate they really need to. Turnover being a huge one. So one of our partners, before, he used to have a temp agency staff primarily, and he began to realize that he was constantly having to fill positions. And in 1 year, 15 people turned over, and he had to keep retraining, rehiring, and he wasn't able to concentrate on other aspects of his business because he was trying to fill these holes that were coming up in terms of labor. And what he started to realize was a lot of his staff were working other jobs, maybe not necessarily telling him about it, but out of necessity because they were making so little. And it's a manufacturing environment. So then you have to look at, well, if you have employees in manufacturing working second jobs, maybe third jobs, what does that bring to the workplace? Fatigue. Are they going to be able to make something that's as good as if they were rested?
Well, I'd be concerned about safety issues. I mean, in a factory setting, health and safety is a huge issue, right?
Well, in a lot of settings, and they found the rate of errors grow up substantially when people are quite simply sleep deprived or exhausted. And so he realized he didn't want to run it that way anymore and started transitioning to a workplace that didn't use temp agencies and used permanent staffing. And he raised his wage to over $17 an hour. Oh, yeah. So he went from 15 people turning over in 1 year to, I believe, only having 3 turnover in 5 years.
That's incredible.
And that is, you know, from a human perspective, that's obviously key and a huge I'm trying to think of the right words. It's a huge incentive on the employee end. Obviously, you're more likely to stay if you're making enough to simply live on.
Yep.
And you're more likely to do a better job if you're not trying to do 3 of them at once. From the employer side, think of the cost savings and the customer and client retention of having a reliable workforce. Suddenly, he could leave people in charge and delegate in a way he couldn't before because he had fully trained staff that were staying.
Yeah. The cost of having a vacant position is around $5,000 and takes about 60 days to fill. So like that in and of itself, right? And then plus the client retention, right? Because when you're in a sales or in a customer service business, like there's no doubt that it's relationship based.
Well, and I find it interesting that a lot of the sectors that are the lowest paid, so for example, food and retail, that's where we often hear, we can't do it, it's going to cost too much. But when you look at these people are the direct face of your company, they're the ones that are interacting with a customer or a client, and they might be the reason a customer or client returns or never returns. Yeah. I can't think of the exact number, but I think it's somewhere along the lines of, if you have a bad experience at a restaurant, you'll tell 7 people. If you have a good experience, you'll tell 1.
Yeah.
And it's the thing of, we remember our really horrible experiences, sadly, much more clearly than a time when everything ran smoothly. And word of mouth does spread. And one employer actually brought up the really good point. It's not just, you don't just have to worry about word of mouth when it comes to customers. Employees talk. They talk to their families. They know people in the community. And they could be the reason that people aren't coming once people find out how they're treated. You know, if you saw the kitchen, or if this is happening in the background, they're talking to each other. So not only does that potentially hinder future customer attraction, it will affect your ability to attract and retain other employees. So I've certainly been in this position, and I know many who have, where you leave a company that has bad working conditions. you're not about to refer a good worker that you've worked with to your newly vacant position. So whereas true. If you had a good experience and you leave, you might refer other people to apply. That is absolutely not happening if you go quietly into the night. And as one of our partners puts it, the good people leave. They leave quietly usually.
Yeah. So did you find Glassdoor as a telling tool in any way?
Glassdoor is telling, and Glassdoor wasn't necessarily useful to me in terms of finding the best companies as much as ruling companies out. And one thing that I found quite fascinating, we can get into this later with the decisions that came out, or recommendations rather, 148, a lot of the companies that have had the most strong opposition to it, if you go into their Glassdoor ratings. So with Glassdoor, it's interesting that I find a lot of companies that maybe come out vocally against raising wages or better scheduling. If you go to that company's Glassdoor, or Indeed is quite helpful as well, and you look at the employee reviews, there is a definite correlation. And I won't say the name of the business, but there's one in particular that spoke at the Bill 148 hearings, strongly opposed to raising wages and strongly opposed to better scheduling. Their employee reviews are abysmal. One person said it was the worst place they've worked in 26 years.
Wow.
And as a corollary with customers, if you look at Yelp and Google reviews or Facebook reviews, sometimes those are quite telling as well. So someone complained that they couldn't find anyone that worked there, or the service was really bad that they did receive, or the employees seemed exhausted or didn't care. The food quality had gone down. So you can definitely find a connection between employee reviews and customer reviews. And I don't think it's an accident that the businesses in the Better Way Alliance, their employee reviews are better, but their customer reviews are better. Because who's going to give better customer service? Someone that's going to do just enough to not get fired and has sort of got one foot out the door. Maybe they're looking for other things or literally doing other jobs when they're not at this job. Or someone that is being treated with respect. They're able to meet their needs, and you know, not extravagant needs, even basic needs in many cases. And they're able to concentrate on what they're doing. Generally, we work harder when we know we're valued.
That would be very true.
And I find that sentiment, if you say that to anyone, I mean, this organization is nonpartisan, so across the political spectrum, if you say to someone, do you work harder when you feel valued? The answer is yes. So I'm not, you know, it's not saying anything radical. And yet sometimes it feels like it is in terms of the discourse that's out there.
That's very true. So I've seen so much Twitter and so much in the news and everything about these different companies coming out and just so vehemently saying, you know, I'm going to move. I'm not going to stay in Ontario. I'll go somewhere else. You know, I can't afford this. Often they're very service industry oriented organizations or companies, I should say. And how do you combat that?
There's a couple points to that. So first of all, the jobs that are the hardest to automate often pay the lowest. So we're looking at, you know, servers, cooks. A lot of people talk about national fast food chains automating, but they actually found when they were putting in these ordering machines, they had to hire more staff because the volume of orders was going up to handle them. Or if it's broken or a customer accidentally hit the wrong button and they have to help with them. A lot of service jobs involve completely unrelated skills. So say you're dealing with a person, maybe you're trying to calm them down, maybe you're preparing food on the side and ringing something. Like, a lot of them require a lot of very different tasks. You know, we're not talking about doing the same task 240 times a day. That is a thing. And many of those jobs have already been automated, but they have variable tasks. I also look at it from the perspective of businesses need customers to exist. So that was the whole concept behind Ford when it started, was if I pay my employees enough to buy the cars they're making, I'm going to sell more cars. And so when we look at the, you know, reasons, oh, if we have to pay restaurant workers more, the restaurant industry is going to collapse. Well, it's worth noting that the restaurant industry has been saying that for every minimum wage increase in our province's history, that all the restaurants are going to collapse. And yet, I walked by 27 restaurants on my way here. There are ways to adapt. And people having the income to be able to maybe even get takeout. Or, you know, there are people who they'll get a coffee, but a croissant feels too decadent, so they're just going to get that coffee. If people are going out for a celebration, are they ordering an entire meal or are they ordering a Sprite? And I think these little incremental decisions, when you times it by 1.5 million people in this province earning $15 or less, those incremental decisions add up. And having a larger number of people with disposable incomes will directly benefit retail organizations, local stores. I mean, that whole concept of shopping local. For a lot of decision, for a lot of people, their decision isn't, you know, do I buy this locally made t-shirt? It's, can I get a Danish with my coffee? Is that a decision I can make today? And when I was talking to workers before doing the employer videos, I asked people, what is one purchase you felt guilty about making?
Oh, any, that's such a good question.
Any guesses as to what those purchases were?
What?
Every single person said food.
Really?
So someone said, you know, if I go get a coffee and a cookie, I feel guilty I got the cookie. Not because of the calories, but because I shouldn't have spent that, you know, $1.75. Someone said getting a bottle of juice when I could have brought it from home. Those kinds of decisions. Every single person felt guilty about buying a snack or a coffee. So I think a lot of people, you know, oh, they're going to go on these vacations and do this. The daily spending, it's the difference. I mean, I know people that have felt guilty about, did I really need to buy those crackers? Because they, you know, they were a seasoned brand, is a little decadent. And these are the decisions that people are making every day. So the quote that I like from Nick Hanauer is, paying restaurant workers enough to eat in restaurants isn't bad for the restaurant business. And you're not going to see those customers that are avoiding you because they can't afford to go out. So it's one of those things that over time, as people have more income in their pockets, that's when you'll see the benefits. But you have no idea how much profit or how much business you're losing because people simply can't spend.
The backlash that the employers, you initially said that employers were seeing a lot of backlash from other employers.
I think there's more of a fear than the reality. Okay. So there has been a bit of backlash for some of the employers that have been more vocal. And I think it's key to note in the Alliance, there are people who are at different levels of vocal. So maybe someone just endorses the concept of offering decent work and offers it in their workplace. Not everyone's going to write an op-ed. That's perfectly fine. That takes a lot of time and effort, and a lot of small businesses, they just don't have a lot of time because they're managing a bunch of different things. And then for some members of the Alliance that are more outspoken about why they want to see things implemented, there has been a tiny bit. But I think by and large, it's harder, again, to make that argument, well, what do you know about running a business, to someone that's currently running a business and is explaining the reasons that it works for them. And I think this type of alliance was overdue in a lot of ways because we have so many negative examples that we're not hearing enough from the positive examples. And what I'm slowly realizing is there are some companies that are very vocal, like we pay higher than average wages, we're very outspoken about how we would like to see the climate improved province-wide and support legislation. But there are a lot of companies that are doing it because it's just how they've retained and attracted good staff that I'm slowly finding out about through word of mouth that that's not, some companies use it as part of their marketing and other companies are just doing it and we don't even necessarily know that that's going on. So I think that's, it's really important to have had the time and the ability to be able to research. And I can see it growing over time because we've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and a lot of the employers themselves are very willing to talk about their strategies in the business community. And we're actually doing a conference September 12th. Smart Employers Talk, Building a Better Economy, One Job at a Time.
Is that at Ryerson?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and that will be several of our members from Better Way Alliance are actually going to be presenting on their businesses from a variety of sectors. So food, retail, manufacturing, IT, service, etc. And if it seems like there's a broad range in the Alliance, that was quite intentional, because I wanted to show that you can apply it to different size businesses, different ages of businesses, and different sectors. I mean, how high in the end you can go with the wage can be sector dependent, but I think it's key to note that we have food and retail partners who've been doing it. And one of our businesses was started by someone in her 20s, has paid $15 an hour from the get-go. She builds it into her business model. Then we have companies where maybe they were paying less, realized they had a problem with turnover and improved their wages, and are now speaking about the benefits of as someone that transitioned. And there's one business, the Knifeware Group. They actually have 10 stores Canada-wide, and it was started by a chef on a bike. And so the way I look at it, I think a lot of the times we're hearing about small businesses can't do it. And the response I've gotten from the small businesses that are doing it is that it's crucial for their success. If you've only got, say, you know, 10 employees, each one of those employees is probably doing multiple things. And the ability to rely on them is huge, because you can't always be everywhere.
That's very true. So we've talked a lot about the minimum wage, because that's really poignant right now. But the Alliance also covers other, as you were mentioning before, other forms of compensation and acknowledgement and recognition, right? So what have you seen as far as speaking out there and the benefits of each of those areas as well?
Scheduling and paid sick days have been the two that come up a lot. And primarily with our retail and food partners, they've been very vocal on those issues, because scheduling and paid sick days are often not in food or retail. With the companies that are more office-based or construction-based, there is a bit more regularities in those departments, just industry-wide, though not always. But what our food and retail partners have discovered is, again, the same thing. When people know when they're going to work, they're able to plan better. If someone is wondering if they're going to be working tomorrow, or should they book a shift with their other job, how focused are they going to be able to be with a customer? How great is the experience going to be? If you're wondering, do I work tomorrow? Do I have to schedule a sitter? Where am I going? And I find it interesting that our food and retail partners have worked at companies where maybe scheduling was an issue, and they saw what the downsides were. And I think that firsthand experience as an employee has often been crucial to our partners developing better employer practices, because I think you oftentimes have to experience how you're living when you're dealing with bad scheduling or no access to paid sick days, and then multiply that by every single one of your workers. It is a little easier to visualize that if you've been a worker in an organization that doesn't have those things.
Very true.
And with food, what's crucial is, you know, not only does it not really look great if you have a visibly ill server serving you, and I've had that experience recently, and I see it completely differently now in terms of my first thought, it didn't reflect badly on the worker to me that I had a very ill person serving me coffee. It reflected badly on the company, because I knew right away that worker looks like they can barely stand with the flu, does not want to be there. They have to, or they'll lose the wage that wouldn't be that much that they desperately need to meet basic needs. No one wants to go in when they feel like they're going to throw up. And the bakery that's one of our partners, it was her observation. She'd worked in hospitality before. She's seen people prepare food, run to the bathroom, throw up, come back, and make food. And she absolutely did not want that to be a part of how she ran her company. It's not fair. People take longer to get better, for starters, if they're coming into work. So you're just extending the process. And from a customer point of view, no one wants to be exposed to someone else's flu when they eat their sandwich. And so that's why she has 9 employees and sick day policies already in place in advance of Bill 148, because a lot of businesses look at it as you can't afford not to offer these things. If someone is ill and they have a fever and they make a mistake and you lose a client, that can apply to any industry. If they have an accident, what you'll have to pay in workman's comp as a result of them having to come in when maybe they're woozy or just need a day to get better could be substantially more than just covering a paid sick day. And again, it's those hidden costs don't ever get talked about. They're getting talked about more now, but not nearly at the rate of a lot of people just look at their labor costs and they're not actively analyzing the other costs that are happening as a result. And again, you don't know that that customer that got served by someone with the flu made a mental note. I don't think I'll come back here. It doesn't seem very clean. Or I don't like that that staff member had to come in sick, whatever angle they're coming at it from. It doesn't reflect well on the company.
That's so true. And really interesting. So I know you mentioned before you wanted to talk about the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about the bill? Because it's being voted on in, I want to say October. I don't know if I'm correct. I know in the fall.
In the fall.
Yeah. But there's no date set yet.
I don't think so. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way to look at the bill as well, a lot of it is overdue for starters. And for many of our partners who've been doing this for years, it will, you know, basically bring their competition up to the level that they have already been operating at, which encourages more decent work practices to spread. I think a lot of the opposition comes from, well, if I'm going to have to pay this on labor costs, then my competition is going to kill me. But the thing is, everybody is going to have to abide by this new playing field. So that isn't actually going to come in the form of, you know, someone else coming in and cannibalizing your customers, because everyone will be brought up to this level. So I know from the terms of companies that are already paying a higher wage or a living wage, this is welcome news in terms of welcome. And a lot of companies are willing to help give advice on the operational changes and different ways you can structure your workplace in order to make it possible. And I think there is a lot of excitement around that increased spending power, people being able to go out and do things in their communities. And I know no one, I don't think anyone is saying that it's not challenging to run a business. And every single one of our partners would say that it is. But they've looked at the kind of business they want to run and how much stress they want in their lives.
That's fair.
And the peace of mind from knowing that the people that are working with you are dedicated themselves and you can trust them and vice versa has always been worth it for them. And in terms of the bill, it will foster more local spending power. And it's hard, I think, for some people. I find it interesting that we're so good at seeing all of the ways it can go wrong and not all of the ways it can go right. So there's so much focus on, and this is going to collapse, and this is going to collapse, and this is going to collapse. Well, what about someone who made the decision to finally go out and buy a pair of glasses? That happened to someone I know that got a raise to 15 recently. It wasn't spent on, you know, anything frivolous. It was spent locally.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other debate, and glasses should be covered. But when you look at what people are able to do, you know, suddenly if someone's able to go to the movies more, and maybe not even a lot, maybe they weren't going at all and now they go 3 times a month. Again, that might seem small if you look at it individually, but times it by 1.5 million people, the spending power is definitely there. Maybe someone isn't replacing something that's broken, and getting that raise is their ability to go out and fix that laptop instead of trying to tinker with it or like make do. I know someone that had a rubber band on their computer at one point. How is that good for business? How is people avoiding participating and being socially included good for businesses that offer forms of social inclusion, whether that be restaurants, movies, going out to an event? We really need to start talking more about the positive ramifications of improving it. And again, no one's going to say that everything's going to be easy, but if doing nothing worked, we wouldn't be talking right now. And that has been quite a global phenomenon as well, if you look at global competition. But as this becomes more of a global movement, it again will begin, it'll begin to be moot if someone says, well, I'm going to move over to this country. Well, if that country starts enacting more living wage policies and more places are doing this because they're looking at what's happening between the growing divide, where are you going to move it to? And who's going to buy your products? Like, you can move your production elsewhere. The people you're selling your products to might be right in front of you, but they're not going to be able to buy them if they don't have enough money. What's a bit tricky here is just the way our laws work. We can't pass things city by city. So I know another criticism is, oh, well, you know, it's a lot more expensive to live in this city than that city. And I completely agree. As someone that has lived in Toronto and Hamilton and St. Yeah. Catharines, there are very wildly different costs of living. Those absolutely need to be addressed as well. But we need a standard. We need a floor. And the way our current laws work, we have to, you know, get at this provincially. And the benefits will be spread provincially too. I know people that were looking for work in Hamilton and were making 15 in Toronto, and they couldn't get anywhere near that in Hamilton. So they commuted 4 hours a day from Hamilton to Toronto to keep that $15 an hour job rather than, so I think it's actually quite exciting to see what can happen to communities that have had a dearth of good jobs when this floor is raised.
That the 4 hour commute. I've done a 4 hour commute. That is,
it's long.
That's long.
And yeah. I mean, if you look at it as well too, that money they're spending on transit is not being spent in the community. That was money that maybe could have been spent on going out to restaurants or, you know, going out and, you know, replacing that pair of torn jeans. Very simple purchases that someone might not be making because of how they're being forced. And super commuting is becoming more and more of a thing as well. People are commuting farther and farther distances.
This is also true.
In the cities that have done it in the States, they have seen numerous benefits. And I have read in terms of what was going on with Seattle. So they actually found there was one restaurant that moved to it 2 years in advance. So they moved to the 15 before they had to because they knew it was coming. And they actually found that their revenue went up.
Wow.
It was Ivar's, I think is the name of it. It's a seafood restaurant. So their revenues went up and all of their servers were happier and making more consistent money and able to do things like take a course. So the customer service is improved as well. One thing I'd like to add as well, and I hear this come up a lot in the discussions here. Well, servers get tips. That varies wildly depending on what kind of restaurant you're working in. You know, a breakfast diner is going to be very different than another form of restaurant. But aside from that, I find the people that make that argument are not bringing up back of house positions at all. Cooks, dishwashers, bussers, all of those other positions. And I might add, there actually is a shortage of cooks and qualified bakers because a lot of them require culinary school, but then you might start at $12.50 an hour and it's not enough to actually live on. And it can be quite laborious, long days. I'm a daughter of a chef, so I'm well aware of like all of the hospitality. They're on their feet. It can be very, very toasty in the back, and the back of house is not really being included in these discussions at all. And there are restaurants that have expressed frustration that they can't attract cooks or they lose their cooks quickly, and it's people need to be able to live. And again, it's a skill. The bakery that's one of our partners said it takes about a year to get a baker fully up to speed, so she's very selective in the hiring process because you're investing a year with the person and you want to try your best to hope that it works out. So that is often overlooked as well, is the skill and the time it takes for someone to get quick at something and to do something consistently and well. Those are all skills, and it's really frustrating to hear a lot of jobs that require a number of skills be described as unskilled, for starters. We all get better at something over repetition and time. And the human skill element of it being completely left out of the equation.
I agree. Okay, so I know you've been here a long time as you survived our technical difficulties earlier. So how can people get in touch with you and learn more? And also, what can people do to get involved and help advocate for better working conditions and with the upcoming political opportunity as well?
There's a few ways. So for Better Way Alliance, it's betterwayalliance.ca. So there's videos and case studies on there and partner endorsements, again, from a variety of sectors. So just kind of talking about their experiences and why they did what they did. There's also a Facebook group, which is Better Way to Build the Economy. So we have info that goes up there and articles and videos, etc., graphics. I think it's twofold. If you're an employer and you're already offering more than the minimum and it's working for you, be vocal. I mean, how vocal and what extent and medium, that's up to you. But I think we do really need to hear these stories. And for some people that have always done it, maybe they think their story doesn't matter, but it absolutely does. If they're interested in joining the Alliance, by all means, info@betterwayalliance.ca. But if you're, you know, not able to participate in that format, I think it's really good to talk to other businesses and see why they're doing what they're doing. And one of our partners, what he actually did is he now only subcontracts to other living wage businesses. So they're primarily carpentry, but if they bring in a plumbing company or an electrical company, they're making sure their living wage businesses as well. And many would argue again, well, that type of work already pays a lot, but not necessarily at the apprentice level. And there are obviously some companies that maybe aren't abiding by all of the regulations, so not at that level either. But it's a good, I think when companies can make changes to their supply chain, that is a very important move. You know, if you're going to get your coffee from a company for a meeting and you're able to support a business that pays a better wage and that's something that's important to you, there are a lot of ways that you can encourage this kind of type of employment and make it grow. Some people are willing to have very frank conversations like, oh, so how is this coffee shop managed? Some people are willing to do that. I can see that wouldn't be for everyone, but basically if you're already on board, be vocal. If you're on the fence, ask a lot of questions, like, is there a company that you admire their model or what they've been able to do? We work with Muskoka Brewery as well. When they came out that they were living wage, they did get contacted by other breweries. What changes did you make? What have you done operationally to be able to do this? Again, depends on the competition, how friendly it is, like who you can talk to. But I guarantee you that if you're coming from a sincere and maybe not a troll place, because that's always going to be an element online, how are you doing this? What benefits have you seen? What was challenging and how did you deal with it? Those are great questions. And if you don't want to hear them from someone that's never owned a business, then ask them from a business that's already doing it. Because I think they're examples, but there needed to be examples to show what could be possible on a more massive scale province-wide. And I think ultimately we need to ask ourselves, what kind of work do we want to encourage? Do we want to encourage work where people can spend as little as possible? You know, the Netflix and chill argument. Oh my, the Netflix and chill thing. Very quickly, my rant on that is, why do you think Netflix and chill is such a thing? It's not because everyone is antisocial. It's great. I love Netflix. I watch it a lot. However, I also know a lot of people watching a lot of Netflix because they literally cannot afford to do anything else. So the Netflix and chill generation could also be called the working poor generation, but that's a whole other argument. But if you want to encourage the kinds of businesses where people are able to do the very things that create more jobs, that's got to come from all of us. And there are business owners that have expressed concern about improving standards, but in tandem have expressed concern that their kids aren't landing good jobs and are living at home and are having to stay with them longer. And if everyone operates from the mindset of lowest common denominator work, that is what's going to be there for your children. Lowest common. And if you want your kids to have a better climate than the one you're contributing to, well, that's maybe an internal discussion you have to have. But raising the standards for everyone is the way to go. And we didn't get to this point out of nowhere. I think no matter where you are on the wealth echelon. At some point, you hopefully have had a conversation with someone who has struggled, or knows someone who knows someone whose kid has great credentials and can't get work that's remotely secure, isn't able to move out of their house, and we need to look at the systemic reasons why this is becoming more of a thing. Full disclosure, I'm 34 and I have three roommates, so we all have jobs. So, you know, if we are okay with the society where it takes four full-time incomes to rent one home, I don't know how a family. But I think generally, when you start to see these patterns developing, you know, we're not blaming one individual or one individual company. It's systemic. And the only way to fix it is with a group effort. Yeah. And really addressing those systemic issues instead of just hoping it'll get better on its own. Because if that's the case, then wouldn't be here. This wouldn't be a discussion that is cropping up globally. It's not just us.
Yes.
This is being tangled with everywhere. And we really need to look at where we want to go in terms of what kind of climate we're creating. And there definitely no one can say there hasn't been a shift. Everyone's had a parent or an aunt or a relative that worked at the same company until they retired. Well, that's not a thing anymore.
I was just about to say, I can't remember the last time I know someone doing that, really. Yeah. Now.
Yeah. It's a lot of short-term contracts and hopping or maintaining multiple. The other one, well, to look at the systemic issues, you just have to look at terms that are used now that weren't used as widely before, like side hustle.
Oh, yeah.
Side hustle culture is very interesting. It's like no qualms with anyone that does a side hustle. We've all had to do extra work. However, if it's becoming a trend where even a full-time job requires a side hustle,
yeah,
maybe the quality of what we're offering as a society has degraded. I don't ever remember. My grandparents were very resourceful. I'm trying to think if any of them ever used the word side hustle. Not, you know, gig economy, side hustle. There's a lot of glorification of, you know, work three jobs, woo.
Yeah.
Just the patterns there are a bit terrifying, but I do think it is possible to address it on an individual level outside the business owner end. We can start to look at the kinds of companies we're patronizing. Obviously, in the current climate, it's impossible to only shop at businesses that pay for wage in some communities. It's certainly affected how I purchase different things now when possible. Or now sometimes if I see a menu item that seems suspiciously low for what it is, my next thought is, I wonder what the people here make. So that's, you know, you start to look at the patterns of certain things. It's one of those things I joke, it's like the pill in the matrix. Once you start to study the patterns and the systems, you can't unsee them. The next time that you see someone in a restaurant and they're serving you and they look sick, think about what would make you go into work that ill.
Yeah.
It's likely they can't afford to stay home, or in some cases will outright lose their job if they do. So as an individual, look at purchasing, and also talking to people. I mean, if you've made a transition from a precarious position to a more secure position, what impacts has that had on your life? Like, can you give concrete examples to people? If you're still trapped in precarity, I highly recommend cultivating a group of people who've also struggled with precarity, because that's when you really, I think it's when we get kind of isolated, it starts to feel like I'm the only person that's dealing with this job situation. And then when you actually start talking, like, oh, I thought, because it's in our culture to hide it too, which is, I think, to a degree why it's kind of gone, for lack of a better word, untreated for so long, is because we really encourage as a society to hide your living situation if it's not reflective. Instagram being a perfect example of that. And I don't know that behooves isn't really the right word. I don't know if that will lead us kind of hiding our situations from everyone is really going to benefit us in the end in terms of being more open about these things, because it's very easy to be like, oh, that person's fine.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily know what they're not purchasing or what they're avoiding. And, you know, if you have a certain friend that maybe is precariously employed and they're never really able to come out to things, maybe it's not that they don't want to. So it's just honestly being more open, being more vocal. And from an individual level, there's a lot of obviously great campaigns like 15 and Fairness that you can get involved with. I think the one misconception kind of going around now, sort of like battle's done deal, everything's fixed. But obviously nothing is set in stone yet. And it really will take a concerted effort to change things after them kind of going like this for so long.
Yeah.
I mean, when I entered the workforce in 2000, the minimum wage had been frozen for 5 years already at $6.85. And then it was frozen for the next five.
Oh.
So I know there's a lot of too much too soon, but where were those voices when it was frozen?
Yeah.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
So
I feel like right now we're at a really pivotal point because the vote is coming up, so that if you are going to take action, if you were sitting on the couch and going, maybe I'd like to be involved somehow, this would be the opportune moment to do so, because this is the moment where your voice may be heard the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right before this potential change.
Well, and again, it's movements are stronger the more people that get involved and the more people that are vocal. And I know a lot of the times people are scared and they're worried about price increases or they're worried about firings. And so there's literature on the Better Way Alliance website. There's reports. We often post articles of what's happening in other places that have raised their minimum wage. Fight for 15 in Fairness does the same. There's a lot of good research being done out there. If you even just look back a bit historically, you will see that these arguments have been made since the Industrial Revolution. And getting rid of child labor did not kill all jobs that needed to happen. And improving the quality of jobs isn't a job killer.
Very true. Wonderful. Well, I think we'll end on that note, which is perfect. So thank you again. Thank you so much for coming, and I really appreciate it. And thank you for expounding so beautifully on all these issues.
Get involved and stay vocal. And I know it's sometimes easy to feel like you're just going to have Facebook fights with relatives, but once you've experienced it yourself, it's hard to unsee. And just, you know, pay attention. And when you see a good initiative and say a company or an organization or nonprofit's been really outspoken, support them. I think people forget sometimes that support is really important too, you know. Just the backlash that many organizations are dealing with, supportive voices are always great. No, I completely see what you're saying. This is why. This is my experience. And share those experiences. It's really important.
Absolutely. Wonderful. So, thank you again.
No problem.
Thanks again for joining us for our second episode of Smash the Ceiling, a podcast on social hiring. We hope you'll come back for our third episode as we chat with Ina Labuschagne from 15 in Fairness as we continue the conversation about Bill 148. We'll also be chatting with Zara and Mariko from Old School General Store. They're a small business which also does social hiring, and they can talk about their practices and why they feel it's valuable. Also, please don't hesitate to reach out to us at Peer Pathways TO on both Instagram and Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
Asking for a wage that is fair. We want laws that are fair for everybody, and that's not something that they should be scared of.
I think you really just have to give them a chance, give them a trial, or else how can you know? It's like dating. Right? What do you, like, you can't just say no to everybody just because, I don't know, you didn't like their hair at that one moment.
St. Stephen's Community House would like to thank United Way, as well as the Ministry of Advanced Education and Skills Development and Employment Ontario, for their continued support with this project. We would also like to acknowledge Monk Turner for allowing us to use Judicious Jude for our music, as well as Satunium for the percussive loop.